Our scripture reading today comes from 1 Samuel chapter 23 and verses 14 to 29. David stayed in the wilderness strongholds and in the hills of the desert of Ziph. Day after day, Saul searched for him, but God did not give David into his hands. While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. The Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh, on the hill of Hakilah, south of Jeshimon? Now, your majesty, come down whenever it pleases you to do so, and we will be responsible for giving him into your hands." Saul replied, "The Lord bless you for your concern for me. Go and get more information. Find out where David usually goes and who has seen him there. They tell me he is very crafty. Find out about the hiding places he uses and come back to me with definite information. Then I will go with you. If he is in the area, I will track him down among all the clans of Judah." So they set out and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. Now David and his men were in the desert of Maon, in the Arabah south of Jeshimon. And Saul and his men began the search. And when David was told about it, he went down to the rock and stayed in the desert of Maon. When Saul heard this, he went into the desert of Maon in pursuit of David. Saul was going along one side of the mountain, and David and his men were on the other side, hurrying to get away from Saul. And as Saul and his forces were closing in on David and his men to capture them, a messenger came to Saul saying, "Come quickly, the Philistines are raiding the land." Then Saul broke off his pursuit of David and went to meet the Philistines. That is why they call this place Selahamalekoth. And David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. This is the word of the Lord.
When we discovered what the reading was, John said, "I don't know what you're going to get out of that." But we're going to move on. There's good stories to go with it. When I worked in Northampton, I had two options for going home. One was to drive through the industrial estate, which was a dual carriageway and sometimes a bit quicker, and the other was a nice country route through some fields. And either way, the distance was about the same, about 3 miles. On one occasion, I chose the country route, which was a fairly quiet road, and fields on both sides, and my speed was, I suppose, around 40. It wasn't particularly fast. But someone came up behind me much faster. He tailgated me. This guy came behind me, tailgated me, and he didn't think I was going fast enough. And then he roared past me and slammed on his brakes. Just imagine, can't you? Did he hope I would drive into his back so he could make an insurance claim? That was a fairly common fraud at the time. You might remember that one. If you drove into the back of another vehicle, it was deemed to be your fault, so it would be his word against mine. Fortunately, my reactions and my brakes were good, and a collision was avoided. It's called road rage. Now so many people have dash cams that it's unlikely to happen. But you can get the picture. And it's strange sometimes, isn't it, that some of those who were, in ordinary life, nice, quiet, gentle, polite people, once they get behind the wheel of a car, have a personality transplant. But I think perhaps some of those are outweighed by those kind people who stop to let you get out of a turning. But how do you deal with infuriating people? How do we deal with matters when we are unfairly treated? We probably don't have anyone running around trying to kill us. But there are plenty of occasions when people make us angry and we might possibly want to seek revenge. At one time I worked in an office in Kettering and the older gentleman in charge of the office decided he would like to go home for a hot lunch each day. He lived within walking distance, but he felt an hour wasn't quite long enough for him to get there and back, so he needed a longer lunch break. So he decided, without consultation, that all the staff would have a longer lunch break, 1.5 hours. And then we'd all go home 1/2 hour later. There was absolutely nothing I could do about it. No one else seemed bothered because they all lived locally, so they had the option to go home as well. I lived 15 miles away. And that change meant that it would be after 6 o'clock when I got home, because then I'd be in the heart of the rush hour. When I arrived home, I needed a meal before I moved on to the next thing, probably some sort of church activity. And I couldn't find a way to deal with it then, and in the end, I just applied for a job nearer home. But we might want to lash out against those who treat us unfairly, those who seem to be against us. Proverbs 24:29 says this, "Do not say, 'I'll do to him as he has done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did.' Don't do that." But David's problems were much more serious than any that we might face. Saul had become insanely jealous of David. Saul, you remember, was king, and David had risen from his position as shepherd boy, who'd come in and killed the Philistine giant Goliath, to a position in King Saul's household, playing the lyre and singing for him. He'd also become a close friend of the king's son, Jonathan, and he'd risen to a high rank in Saul's army. He was so good a soldier and so extremely popular that people made a pop song about David. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. And somewhere along the line, Saul has discovered that David was in line to become king after him, rather than his son, Jonathan. So Saul was jealous, and his rage extended beyond any normal animosity. Saul could suddenly turn violent, and as his rage became more prolonged, he set out to kill David. And all of this was against a background of wars with the Philistines. David seems to have gathered a cohort of faithful men around him, about 600 of them, it says. Perhaps they were people from his own tribe. So David was fighting the Philistines, Saul was fighting the Philistines, and in the midst of it, Saul was trying to kill David. Actually sounds a bit like those current wars in the Middle East, doesn't it? And Saul's actions may remind us of some of the actions of today's world leaders. Someone once said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and we could say that of Saul. In chapter 23, it tells us that David consulted God before deciding which battle to fight and when to run. And it also tells us that Saul just assumed that God was on his side and would do what he wanted him to do. You can see the difference between the two of them. So David and his men found themselves in the desert region near the Dead Sea. It's very, very dry, except for the little bits where there's water. And today, En Gedi is a tourist spot. It's a national park. When I visited it 50 years or so ago, it was just a dry, dusty bit of desert with some signs of water where there were a few plants growing. When David was there, it may have been even less welcoming. Yes, there was water. The first bit, En, means spring or spring of water, something like that. But it was generally a bit of desert where there were caves right beside the Dead Sea. And that's the setting for our first story. So we've got two more stories coming up. King Saul was on the prowl. Now, he was hunting high and low for David, whom God had lined up as his replacement. Saul's days as king were numbered because he'd just done so badly, he'd made a mess of everything. And the thought of David, who was so popular, filling his shoes was more than he could bear. So King Saul was insanely jealous of David and wanted him dead. So we catch up with them as Saul and 3,000 of his fighting men were scouring the countryside for David. And they got to En-Gedi in the desert by the Dead Sea. And David and his men were hiding deep inside a cave, hoping to evade capture. So it must have been a big cave, because there's 600 of them sitting in the back of this cave. In the meantime, King Saul was desperate for the loo. So he popped into the cave where David and his men were sitting at the back in order to relieve himself. David's men couldn't believe their luck. Here's King Saul, totally vulnerable. They could get him now. Here was their chance to kill Saul before Saul killed them. What should David do? There was Saul, weak and defenseless, totally vulnerable. Well, David tiptoed up behind the king and snipped off the corner of his robe without Saul even realizing it. Saul left the cave, and David felt overwhelmed with guilt. What he'd done? Saul might have fouled up, but he was still king of Israel in God's eyes, and even to think of harming him was wrong. As King Saul left the cave, David chased after him and confessed what he'd done. Called Saul out on it. It says when David finished saying this, when David finished saying that he'd cut off Saul's robe, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You've treated me well, but I've treated you badly. You've just now told me about the good you did to me. The Lord gave me into your hands, but you didn't kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands." Well, it sounds like peace and unity being sought between Saul and David, doesn't it? All be well after that. Everything's going to be okay. But as we'll see in the next story, Saul hadn't really changed and David's life was still in danger. The second story takes place while Saul and his army were fighting the Philistines, and they'd made camp in the desert because Saul thought that David was there and there would be a good opportunity to kill him. David's men were there, and they'd seen where Saul and his army had camped. It was night time and very dark, and David asked for volunteers to go with him and sneak into Saul's camp. He and his friend Abishai sneaked in, and no one stopped them. They were all soundly asleep, and they found Saul there, snoring away with his spear stuck in the ground beside him. The soldiers around him were also snoring their heads off. And Abishai said to David, "Look, you can kill Saul right now. Pin him to the ground with his own spear." Oh, wasn't that tempting? But David said, "No, I will not lay a hand on the one who is the Lord's anointed. His time will come when God decides." So David took Saul's spear and the water jug that was beside him, and they left. And when after that, they stood on a hill opposite Saul's camp, but within hailing distance. And they shouted out first to Abner, Saul's bodyguard, "Why didn't you guard Saul properly? Where's his water jug and spear gone?" And Saul woke up and recognized David's voice. Again, he seemed thoroughly repentant about his vendetta against David. He said, "I've acted like a fool and have erred greatly." And David reiterated his position. "The Lord gave you into my hands today, but I wouldn't lay a hand on the Lord's anointed." And he told Saul to send one of his lads over to collect the jug and the spear. But again, Saul's change of heart was only temporary. Hear more about that in a few more episodes of David, I expect. How did David get to be that sort of person? I think it's something to do with his previous experience of listening to God, of deepening his relationship with God. That was perhaps the key to it. And of course, David was human. And David, as you will see in later installments, didn't always get everything right. But that question comes several times to David. How should he deal with Saul, who had sworn to kill him? David's men keep saying to him, "Kill Saul now while he's in your hands." And David says, "I will not lift my hand against the Lord's anointed." And perhaps for David to kill Saul in cold blood would make David no better than Saul. Now, what about us? I mean, no one's running around trying to kill us, are they? I hope they're not. But listen to the words of Jesus. This is in Luke chapter 6. Jesus says, "But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who ill-treat you. If someone slaps you on the cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he's kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who ill-treat you. How can we do that? More than 30 years ago, I came back to my house after a church prayer group. I was living on my own then. It was before I was married. I lived in an ex-council house in an area that was less than perfect. Opposite my house, I had a garage in a block, so I could lock my car up every night. Didn't want to leave it on the street. But on this occasion, I came home, about 10 o'clock I suppose it was, and discovered that one of my neighbours had parked his car sideways across the entrance to my garage. Get the picture? I couldn't even reach the door to get it to open it, let alone get in. So I didn't want to leave my car on the street. What should I do? I knew who the offending car belonged to. It was a family in the next row of houses. But I didn't want to go and confront a potentially aggressive man late at night and ask him to move it. I was on my own. It wasn't a safe or sensible thing to do. And I could feel the anger and the annoyance welling up inside me. I guess we will be in those sorts of situations. So I went inside, had a hot drink and considered my options. Maybe I could damage his car in some way. Perhaps let down his tyres. That wouldn't help him move it, though. Perhaps I could call in some hefty friends to bounce it out of the way, but that seemed a bit late to try and get them on board. And I'd just been to a prayer group. I shouldn't be feeling those things anyway, should I? So what did I do? I went outside and I walked around as much as I could of the offending vehicle, and I prayed for the occupants that God would keep them safe in their journeys, that they'd be free of accidents and breakdowns, and I prayed that God would bless them and protect them. And when I'd prayed everything I could think of, I went inside and waited to see what would happen. I finished my coffee. Within half an hour, the car owner came and removed his car and put it in a proper parking bay. I put my own car in the garage and went to bed. That wasn't the end of it. A couple of weeks later, I was in church on Sunday. And in that church, we often prayed for people during or after services. And in the prayer area, I found a woman who I didn't know particularly well, and she had her leg wrapped up in bandages. So I asked if she wanted prayer for her leg. I mean, that was the obvious thing. But no, it wasn't that at all. She explained to me how she and her family, and there were three children, lived in the middle of a row of three terraced houses. The occupants of the two adjoining houses were incredibly difficult. They were often drunk and noisy, and they shouted at her children every time they stepped outside. And she was at her wit's end and didn't know what to do. Well, I did pray with her, but I also told her about the person who parked across my garage and how I had prayed for him and his family. And I suggested she try a similar approach, that she and as many of her children as she could involve should find a time when the neighbours were out and walk around the whole block of three houses and pray for them and ask God to bless them. And of course, I said, you do have to mean it. I didn't see her for a few weeks, but then I encountered her again. And she was so excited. She said, I did what you said. And we all prayed right round the block. And then I got a letter from the council. They're relocating us to a bungalow because of my leg condition. Bless those who treat you badly. Isn't that what David was doing? And isn't that what we should all be doing? And of course, when we do that, God's response is absolutely amazing. Jesus says, bless those who persecute you. I'm trying to think of a song that would follow on from that. And we're going to sing, Make Me a Channel of Your Peace.